The following is a special edition of the Lang Money Hour. For those that don't know, Jim Lang has begun holding online webinars in place of his in-person workshops to maintain social distancing safety parameters due to COVID-19. A new addition to his webinar process is a special Q&A webinar dedicated to answering the specific questions of the audience. In this broadcast from one of Jim's most recent webinars, he answers many questions that you yourself may have. And now, Jim Lang.
Thank you. Before we get started with the actual questions, I just wanted to go over one concept because it's so critical, and frankly, it relates to probably half the questions or more. And that underlying principle, the foundation of tax planning, if you will, which Jane Bryan Quinn calls it my mantra, is don't pay taxes now, pay taxes later, except for the Roth IRA. If you've been following me, I've been saying pay taxes later for probably about 30 years and saying pay taxes later except for the Roth IRA for about 20 years, because that's how long the Roth IRA has been around, actually 22 years. Anyway, this foundation principle applies while you are working. And what that means is you should be putting money into your IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, other types of retirement plans, and that is a form of paying taxes later. The exception is except the Roth, which is, again, exceptions to the exceptions. It's probably better to put money in Roth IRA, Roth 401k, Roth 403b in the accumulation stage when you are building money for your retirement. Don't pay taxes now, pay taxes later in the distribution stage. This is when you are now retired and you are looking to your portfolio for the income that you need to support you and your family. And let's say for discussion's sake that you have three chunks of money. One, I'll call after tax or portfolio money. Two, you have IRA and retirement plan money. Three, you have Roth IRA dollars. Again, subject to exception, spend your after-tax dollars that isn't costing you short-term money in taxes. Then spend your IRA dollars and then spend your Roth dollars last. And finally, don't pay taxes now, pay taxes later except for the Roth, even after you're dead. And that has a huge implication for the Secure Act and for the advice that we are giving. And it's one of the reasons why the charitable remainder trust works so well. But the idea is we want our heirs, not just our spouse, although certainly our spouse, but our children and grandchildren to pay taxes later, except for the Roth, even after you're gone. So I'm for those of you who have followed me, I've said this many times, but again, it is the foundation stone, and it is something that if you keep in mind, I think it will help in many areas. So Erica, why don't we start with our first question and see if we can help our audience not only with the question for the person who asked the question, but hopefully some of these concepts and the questions themselves will have application for everybody. So Erica, how about if we get started with our first question?
Absolutely, and I apologize, everyone. Apparently, I am the only person that can make the picture on the screen bigger right now, but I actually cannot figure out how to do that for Jim. So I'll go ahead and get into a question so he can start answering it, and hopefully we'll work out this technical difficulty. Dave in Pittsburgh asked a question about CRUTs, Jim. He said, are CRUTs primarily for those who have $1 million or more in traditional IRAs? Is there an IRA amount that reflects when you should consider this strategy?
Okay, well, first let's start with the basics. So what Dave is talking about when he says CRUT is a charitable remainder unit trust. That's an acronym, CRUT. And what he's referring to is naming a charitable remainder unit trust as the beneficiary of your IRA after you name your spouse. So let's say Dave is in a traditional marriage, original husband, original wife, and same child or children. Well, presumably when he names his, the normal thing to do would be to name his spouse as the primary beneficiary and then to name his child or children equally as the contingent beneficiary. And what I have suggested, and I have some compelling proof, mathematical proof, that many situations, it actually, even if you don't care about charity, it is better for you to leave your IRA to your child or children to this charitable remainder trust than to leave it to your children outright. Well, how is that possible? Again, don't pay taxes now, pay taxes later. The charitable remainder unit trust is one of the exceptions to the SECURE Act. So if you leave it to your child directly, then your child is going to have to pay income tax on that full amount within 10 years of your death. So let's say that, let's forget about growth for a minute. Let's say you leave your kid $1 million in an IRA and you die and the child has to pay $300,000 or $400,000 in taxes within 10 years of your death. So now the child has, say, $600,000 left. The interest on that, say it's 6%, is $36,000. The CRUT is one of the exceptions to the SECURE Act, which means it doesn't have to pay taxes within 10 years. So if you leave this $1 million instead of to your child, to a charitable remainder trust, and to oversimplify, your child gets the income from that trust. That income will not be based on the $600,000 that was reduced by the chunk that the IRS came out. It would be the income on the entire amount, which would be, let's say, 6% times $1 million. So is your child better off with the $600,000 outright or the income on $1 million? That's going to depend on a number of factors, probably the most important of which is how long your child is going to live. The break-even point, I think we determined, were in the 60s, meaning, and if your child lives beyond that, your child is way, way better off if you left the money to a CRUT than to the child outright. The child dies young, then it would have turned out not well. Our answer to that, by the way, is some term insurance to, let's say, keep the family whole. All right, so with that introduction, are the CRUTs primarily for those who have $1 million or more in a retirement plan? And is there an IRA amount that reflects when you should consider this? Well, I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, but this is what I would say. The downside of the CRUT, and we tend to not like one CRUT for more than one beneficiary. So let's say you have three beneficiaries. People say, hey, can I have one trust, one CRUT, charitable remainder unit trust, for three beneficiaries? And that causes a lot of problems and a lot of aggravation. So subject to exception, I usually like to have one CRUT per beneficiary. Now, drafting the CRUT, of course, for us, it's easy, but yeah, it's going to cost a couple bucks, but in the big scheme of things, that's not going to be the major administration expense. The major administration expense for the CRUT is going to come after you and your spouse are gone. And this CRUT becomes this living, breathing entity where you have to file a tax return. You have to file a K-1. The beneficiary must include the K-1 income from on their return. So we're adding, it's hard to say the amount, but I don't want to say less than $1,000 of extra administration expense, maybe more, depending on who the trustee is. So it's real safe to say like $1 million per CRUT. That's a real easy win, meaning a $1 million IRA, one kid. Well, what if you have $800,000 and one kid? That's still pretty good, even though now the administration costs are getting a little bit heavier. Well, what if you have $1 million and two kids? Well, now the administration costs are even higher. Now you could make up for that by saying, well, gee, Jim, I understand what you're saying, but I actually do like charity. I like the idea of my children getting a regular income throughout their lives, the IRS getting the short end of the stick, even if I have to pay $1,000 or $2,000, or not I, my kids, I still like that idea, in which case maybe $1 million with two beneficiaries would still work out okay. So there's no hard and fast rule. If you have, I mean, obviously, if you have 500,000 and five kids, the administration costs are just going to be way out of sight. So I don't have a hard and fast rule, but I would say the more charitable you are, the lower the IRA amount can be and the higher the number of beneficiaries can be. The less charitable you are, the more I want in the IRA and the less kids that I want in order to use this strategy. Okay? And I know, Dave, unfortunately, the way this webinar works and the way our software is I can't say, does that answer your question? But I hope that answers your question. So, Erica, how about if we take the next question then?
Well, you'll actually have another opportunity to answer one of Dave's questions because he actually had two. His next question is about Roth IRA conversions. I noticed that your Roth IRA conversion information often talks about figures like conversions of $100,000 at a time for someone with millions in traditional IRAs. What percentage of your traditional IRAs do you suggest converting if you don't have millions in your accounts?
Well, I'm going to sound like a lawyer, of course, which is the answer is it depends. So what it's really going to depend on, and I would say that this is Roth IRA conversions in general, is you have to take into consideration the most important factor is your current tax rate and either your future tax rate or the future tax rate of your beneficiary. The other factor is how long will this Roth IRA be around? So I don't have anything specific. I will say I'm going to guess in practice, we recommend more Roth IRA conversions of well less than $100,000 than Roth IRA conversions of $100,000 or more. But we also will tend to recommend a series of Roth IRA conversions rather than one big one. And that, if you think about it, that goes back to my idea of the tax rates are so critical. So no hard and fast rules. I will also tell you, and this is kind of complicating life, if you're considering the charitable remainder trust, it is best to go kind of to the Y in the road. You're either going to do the charitable remainder trust or you are not. If you are, when you run the numbers, particularly if you're looking at the next two generations, excuse me, it probably makes sense to have a plan with your charitable remainder trust or no charitable remainder trust, because if you're going to do a charitable remainder trust, the benefits of the Roth IRA are not as great, or looked at another way, the benefits of the charitable remainder trust are greater if the balance in the traditional IRA at death is greater. That's one of the problems with running the numbers, is that you can't just say, okay, I'm going to run the numbers for Roth. Okay, I'm done with that. Okay, now I'm going to do it for Social Security. Okay, I'm done with that. Okay, I'm now going to do it for charitable remainder trust. Okay, I'm done with that. Now I'm going to do it for gifting. Okay, I'm done with that. Okay, now I'm going to do it for how much money you can safely spend. Okay, I'm not. Because virtually every one of these factors has an influence on the other factors. So again, I hate to sound like a lawyer and say it depends, but I would say more times than not, we are recommending a series of Roth IRA conversions, which for most people is well less than $100,000 per year.
Great. The next question comes from Lad in Lebanon, Connecticut. It's about CARES Act tax strategy. Which type of defined contribution plans, IRAs, 401ks, 457s, etc., do repayments of RMDs already taken early in 2020 apply to, and which do not?
Well, for this question, I must confess, I used my lifeline because I didn't know. I actually played hooky yesterday, went on an 80-mile, 8,000 feet of elevation bicycle ride, which I could have never done without the assistance of an e-bike. And when I got back at night preparing for some of the questions that were submitted in advance, I realized I didn't know that. So I emailed our primary estate attorney, who is just terrific in these and virtually every matter regarding IRAs, retirement plans, and estate planning, drafting, estate planning, etc. And he's told me, and I have 100% confidence in this answer, that the answer is it applies to all these types of retirement plans, and the deadline is August 31st. By the way, a quick story about this particular issue. So we have this, our new book is coming out. We're pretty excited about it. It's actually on Amazon right now. You can get it for 99 cents, a whole bunch of bonuses. We haven't released it to our list yet, so you'd be one of the first. But anyway, we are also sending two copies to all our clients because we just think that that's a nice thing to do. And rather than just saying, you know, here's two books, what we did is we went through, and this is for all our asset under management clients, we went through the entire list, and each person was assigned to one advisor. So I had about 90, Matt took a lot, Cheryl took a lot, Steve took a lot, and we developed about 12 statements of where the person should look in the book for their individual situation. So one might say, well, we know you have a disabled child. Please see the chapter that talks about the exception for disabled children to the Secure Act. Or, you know, we know you've done a series of Roth IRA conversions, but with this new information, you might want to do more. So please see chapter 6. So we had about 12 of these, and each advisor was given the role of picking maybe two or three and then putting that in the cover letter. So that way the client, instead of just getting, here's some books, it's like, here's some books, please see, and something that was really applicable to them. But anyway, one of the things was there's no minimum required distribution this year. And if you already made one, you can give it back. Well, we could tell that because we have the birth years of all our clients. So everybody who fit into the right birth year, we had that comment automatically. But at the time, I actually wrote most of the comments. I didn't know the date for giving it back. So after I found the date, I said, oh no, we now have to change that particular statement. So anyway, short answer is you have until August 31st to do all of them. But that's something that we like to keep our clients informed about and is something that we are, let's say that was the one automatic thing that was in our database that we could help our clients with when we sent them the book. Because sometimes, and by the way, the book has a terrific table of contents, so you don't have to fish very long to get the exact piece of information that you are looking for.
So our next question comes from Tom in Marietta, Georgia. He asks, how do you reduce your adjusted gross income to be eligible for the free money Congress is handing out when your AGI has increased because of Roth conversion?
Well, I don't want to get political here and talk about, quote, free money that Congress is handing out. But let me just say that there are obviously benefits to having a lower income. Frankly, most of my clients don't qualify for most of those benefits. Let me tell you one that that actually made a difference for two things. One, Roth IRA conversion, and two, actually when to get married. I was working with a gay couple, significant difference in their financial strength. And one member of the couple was on Obamacare. And because his or her income was very low, the Obamacare premium was pretty small. Well, for a lot of reasons, it made sense to get married. By the way, it's a whole other issue. I actually did two books just for same-sex couples. Now anybody can get married, regardless of sex. If I was to rewrite that book, it would be called Getting Married for the Money, because there's some substantial financial benefits to getting married. But anyway, what we did is we held off on the marriage until they both qualified for Medicare. And then we also held off on Roth IRA conversions for the stronger person because he was able to take advantage of the married filing joint rates and he was able to take advantage of the lower income. So as far as how to reduce your adjusted gross income, I don't have any special magic tricks. I'm not a big fan of, and I'm not saying that they haven't worked in the past. I'll just say I've never sold one, and I don't think I ever will, you know, of these, you know, tax schemes or, you know, real estate deals or equipment deals or, you know, gas and oil when you get all this wonderful depletion and the ads on it look so good that you would think, even if you never get a nickel back from your investment, the taxes are so great. But frankly, I don't like investments where you put in money and you don't get any money back. So I don't have any magical ways to reduce adjusted gross income. You know, there's standard type things, you know, like charitable deductions and increasing your other charitable deductions and, you know, QCDs, which are qualified charitable deductions, which is great for people over 70, actually even say 70 and a half. The good part I liked about the question is recognizing the relationship between your adjusted gross income and Roth IRA conversions, and that that isn't two separate, completely unrelated ideas, but they are in fact very related.
So the next question is from Louise in Louisville, Kentucky, and she asks about Roth conversions. She says, my advisor does not recommend Roth IRA conversions for a person of my age, 78, with a $900,000 balance because I would not have time to recover the costs. I hope to leave most of my IRA to my children. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't want to say anything bad about any other advisor. I really don't. I would say that I profoundly disagree with that advisor. It is possible, Louise, in your particular situation, that it doesn't make sense to do a Roth IRA conversion based on your current and future tax bracket. Without knowing more, I would bet a lot of money that no, you're probably an excellent candidate. Let me tell you what I think your advisor is thinking. Let me tell you why I think he is wrong. And let me tell you why I think you would benefit from a series of Roth IRA conversions. And I went over this a little bit Tuesday, but I'll just reiterate the summary. I believe that the best measure of wealth is not total dollars. It is purchasing power. And I use the example, if I have $1 million in my IRA, if I want to go out and buy goods and services, I might have to pay $350,000 in taxes. So I only have $650,000 left. Where let's say that you have $900,000 in after-tax dollars. Yes, you have less money than me because I have $1 million, but you can go out and maybe a reduction for capital gains, but you can go out and buy roughly $900,000 worth of services, and I can only do $650,000 worth of services. If you use total dollars as your measurement tool, I would probably agree with your advisor in that it's going to take so many years for the tax-free growth of the Roth IRA to overcome the amount of money that you had to pay in taxes, that it's probably not going to pay. But if you use purchasing power as your measurement tool, and by the way, I would highly encourage you to read chapter one of The Roth Revolution. By the way, that's for the people that stay till the end. We have an unbelievable lineup of bonuses. One of them is my dedicated book on Roth IRA conversions. If you read chapter one and review the, or by the way, another hint, just listen to the second video that is going to be one of your bonuses. We talk about Roth IRAs a lot and we talk about that concept. I would guess that particularly, you know, most of my 78-year-old clients who have $1 million in an IRA, they usually have some other stuff too, and they're usually not great spenders, which means they're going to die broke, which means the Roth IRA conversion, I'm going to guess without knowing more, is probably not only great for you, but it's also great for your kids. So with all due respect to your advisor, I profoundly disagree. I actually run into this a lot, and what I think your advisor should tell you, which is the honest answer, is I just don't know enough about Roth IRA conversions to give you a good educated opinion. I suggest that you find one elsewhere. Clint Eastwood says a man's got to know his limitations. If I get an issue that I don't know how to handle, I don't try to guess. I either say, I don't know, I'll try to find out, or in many cases, I refer people out. So if you came to me and said, hey, Jim, I have a $10 million business and one kid's in the business and the other kid isn't in the business, how do I make things fair and I can't afford a life insurance policy? My answer is, I don't know. That's not my area of specialty. Not only is the only area of law that we work in estate planning, but I'd say even more specifically, estate planning for IRA and retirement plan owners. Your advisor should not be giving you advice that is potentially harmful, because without the benefit of this webinar, question and answer period, and some of my books, you might say, oh, okay, well, if that's what he said, I guess he's right. I'll just go ahead and listen to him, which is one of the reasons why I think all these calculators on the web are so, they're worse than nothing, because you go through it, you determine, no, I'm not a good candidate, you forget about it, but they don't only gave you the wrong answer, but they hurt you because you are now confident of your wrong answer. So a long-winded answer to a short question, I profoundly disagree with your advisor, and I think at least on the topic of Roth IRA conversions, you should look elsewhere.
The next question comes from Kurt in Grove City, Ohio. Now, Kurt asked a long question that had a lot of very situational or specific facts that were very specific to him. So Jim looked at your question, and instead of addressing the whole question, he wanted to address an important point that your question hit on, Kurt, which is the distinction between transfer tax and income tax. Can you speak to that, Jim?
Okay, so in our tax system today, Josh, I'm getting a notice on change the battery pack. I don't know if that's here or on your end, but anyway, I'll just keep going. There's basically two taxes, either during our lifetime, although we usually think of them at death. The first is a transfer tax. I remember going back to law school. By the way, I went to Duquesne, which was terrific for me, because instead of having academic professors, they actually had professors that were working in the field. And I had some of the top estate attorneys in the city of Pittsburgh as my law school professors. But anyway, they would distinguish between transfer taxes and income taxes. And the analogy they gave was transfer taxes is whoever owns the tree. So you have an apple tree. At your death, you're going to transfer the apple tree to your child. Is there a transfer tax on that transfer? If you're in Pennsylvania and you're leaving it to your child, it's probably a 4.5% lineal heir tax, and that's for transferring. If you have an IRA, let's say it's $1 million and you leave it to your child, yes, there's probably a 4.5% transfer tax on that IRA, but in addition, nobody has paid income tax on that IRA. So your child eventually will have to. So you have to think about the income tax and the transfer tax. Now, in the old days, most of the estate planning was of trying to avoid the transfer tax. And that's because there was a $600,000 exclusion. And maybe if you went through enough hoops, you could make it $1.2 million for you and your spouse. Well, today it's $11 million something, and you don't even have to go through a few hoops, but easy hoops for you and your spouse to make it $22 million. And yes, there is Pennsylvania or your state, depending on what state you live in. But in terms of federal transfer tax, for most of the people that I work with, and I don't work with the silver spoon, you know, multimillionaire, billionaire types. Most of my clients are, you know, 1 million, 2 million, maybe 4 million, typically in IRAs and retirement plans. We don't have a transfer tax problem. What we have is an income tax problem. So I concentrate on the income tax elements of the retirement and estate plan rather than the transfer tax elements for most people. Now, I have your long question, which I don't have time to read, and it would be a little bit confusing. But I would just say that you have to concentrate on the income tax issues much more than the transfer tax issues. And one other thing that you threw in there that I will mention. You mentioned that, and I don't want to call them a spendthrift, but you mentioned that one child might not be as financially responsible as another child. And the issue then becomes, do you want to trust as the beneficiary of whatever you're going to leave that child? And there, what you have to do is you have to weigh the administrative aggravation, again, just like the charitable remainder trust, of having that trust. The biggest issue is who's going to be the trustee. I'll save you the rant, but I'm not a big fan of banks and corporate trustees. I'm usually a fan of family members, even though if they're smart, the family member won't want to do it, versus what the risk is. So if there's a serious risk, your kid is going to go out and blow money that you leave them, whether it's in an IRA or Roth IRA or after-tax dollars, then that money should probably be in a what's called a spendthrift trust. If that money is in an IRA, the underlying asset that's going to fund that trust is in an IRA or a Roth IRA, then you have to be very careful about the exact language of the trust. And that exact language must have five specific conditions in order to get the tax treatment that is appropriate. And when Matt has looked at this issue, because when somebody comes into us and says, hey, this is Pennsylvania residents only, we look at other wills and we give advice on it, but we can only draft Pennsylvania wills. We're not going to draft a will if what you have is perfectly fine. So we always review what you have before we make a proposal. And we see attempts of setting up a trust when the underlying asset is an IRA or a retirement plan. And I think by Matt's count, somewhere between 90 and 95% of the attorneys, including, with all due respect, some of the big shot attorneys downtown, get this wrong. So you do have to be extra careful. And my feeling about it is, if it's on the borderline, I would probably take the safe route, even if it causes some extra aggravation administratively, because you want to protect your child. You never want to go to your grave worrying that your child's going to be under a bridge when they're 60 or 70. You always want to know that, yes, my child maybe will never have $1 million in their pocket to go out and blow, but they will always have a roof over their head, food on the table, maybe a little bit of money for Saturday night. And if I'm the sibling who is the most likely trustee, yes, it will be a pain in the butt to deal with my spendthrift brother who always wants more money than I think is appropriate. On the other hand, that's better than him running out of money, because what happens when the spendthrift brother runs out of money? Who's he going to go to? He's going to go to the other brother. This is, of course, after you and your spouse are gone. So I'm going to err on the side of having that trust, assuming that there's enough money to justify the administrative costs. Hope that went a little bit beyond the question, but frankly, I have a hard time just sticking to the very, very short answer to the question, because virtually every question has multi-tiers to it, whether it's stated in the question or not.
So the next question is from Bridge in Great Falls, Virginia. And this person has converted all of their IRAs into Roths, and they were wondering if you could spend a few minutes talking about the changes that the SECURE Act has made to tax code that are relevant to Roth IRA specifically.
Okay, so let's assume for discussion's sake, And what, to me, I think what the question is, I mean, he can't convert anymore. So let's not worry about what he can do while he's alive. Let's just worry about what his kids can do after he is gone. With a traditional IRA, again, don't pay taxes now, pay taxes later. The beneficiary of the inherited IRA has 10 years and can take out the inherited IRA whenever he wants or she wants. So they could take it all out in year 10. Well, that's paying taxes later. But the problem with that is that that will inevitably push them into the highest tax bracket, which will cause a very heavy tax. And it might have been better to take a little bit each year, or maybe time it so that you take it when you're in your lowest income year. So let's say, for discussion's sake, you're 17 years old and you just inherited this IRA, and you're going to be in college for the next hopefully four years. Not very few people finish in 4 years anymore. I finished in 3.5, but these days, people are not graduating early. But anyway, it might make sense for you to take out a whole bunch during those years, because you might be in your lowest income bracket ever. With a Roth IRA, however, since there's no income tax for the beneficiary when they withdraw the inherited Roth IRA, and just like a regular IRA, it does have to be distributed within 10 years. The difference is that distribution is income tax free. If the beneficiary can afford it and has other means of supporting themselves, it probably makes sense to wait the entire 10 years. So let's say that you die with, did the question have an amount? Well, let's just keep the math simple. You die with a $500,000 Roth IRA. The money is invested at 7%. 10 years after your death, that inherited Roth IRA, because you didn't have to take any distributions, is now doubled. So now you have $1 million inherited Roth IRA. Now, it does have to be distributed at that point. It's not taxable, so that $1 million will just become a regular brokerage account. But we have found that that additional 10-year period of tax-free growth can be extremely valuable for the beneficiaries, not as valuable as when they could stretch it over their lifetimes, which is like the old law, or if you qualify for one of the exceptions to the new law, but that's still a great strategy. So that is something presumably that your kids should be apprised of, so that they can make the appropriate response after you're gone. And one of the problems that we have, we can do the best plan in the world while you're alive, but most of our planning also requires appropriate post-mortem planning. And we sometimes provide people as much or more value giving the survivor or survivors tax planning action tips rather than sometimes their parents who died. So just as an example, or even to the spouse. So in 2019, we had a whole bunch of multi-million dollar IRA owners die. And the question was, well, what now? And in many cases, we did disclaimers, meaning we skipped the spouse and we went to the next generation. And the next generation got this wonderful stretch. And thank goodness we did that, because now that stretch isn't available. But for the people who were in it, subject to a few exceptions there, that stretch is grandfathered. So post-mortem planning was extremely important. It's still important. And a lot of our planning while you're alive is step one. Then you have to get appropriate advice for step two. In this case, the child should be apprised that if they have other money, they should keep the inherited Roth IRA intact for 10 years after you're gone.
Great. So since we're about a little over half an hour in, I wanted to take a few questions from the live room.
All right, good.
The first question is from Gary, and he asks, if I want to leave IRA funds to three beneficiaries through a charitable trust, will there be one or three trusts?
Well, I touched on this before. Administratively, it's tempting to say one trust because then it is just, you know, one tax return, and there's a little reduction in administrative expenses. The problem then is everything then becomes decision by committee. You know, one beneficiary wants it invested one way. The other beneficiary wants it another way. Another beneficiary might have short-term needs that they want more of the money now. And we didn't talk about NIMCRUTs, which are net income with makeup provision cruts, because it's probably beyond the scope of this, both my book and this Q&A answer. But I will just say that there is some post-mortem planning involved with cruts also, and not necessarily everybody is going to be on the same wavelength. In fact, they probably will not. So to me, that's kind of a formula for unpleasant family interactions after your death. And what I have heard from virtually all my clients is one thing that we don't want is for our kids to fight about money after we're gone. So we go to extreme lengths, even if it does incur some additional administrative costs, even if it does, God forbid, increase taxes for one person. You have to think about the human element. And there's so many cases that we know of where brother doesn't talk to brother or sister doesn't talk to brother due to bad blood on post-death decisions that were made. So I really don't like to have one trust with multiple beneficiaries, even though administratively it might be a little bit less expensive. Hope that does it for you, Gary.
Great. And this question from Steve is very complex. He asks, is there a foreseeable danger to clients that a future Congress could revoke or amend the Secure Act and negate or worsen the tax benefits of creating irrevocable charitable planning strategies, CRUTs, pooled income funds, etc., i.e. create another category in the net investment income tax form 8960, Medicare surtax for income derived from these sources, or any other way of levying additional tax upon, quote, rich people who utilize these strategies?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that there's no chance that Congress is going to change the law in the future in a way that potentially could be unfavorable for these charitable remainder trusts or for Roth IRAs for that matter. So I often get the question, gee, Jim, could they change the tax on inherited Roth IRAs or even just Roth IRAs? And now I pay this big tax up front, and now I find out it's not going to be tax-free. And generally, the answer is, if you're talking about a direct tax, it is part of the Internal Revenue Code, both for the Roth IRA conversions and the charitable remainder trust, that they can't do it's known as an ex post facto, after the fact law that will have a direct impact on the taxability of the charitable remainder trust and the Roth IRA. Now, this question was a little bit more specific. Could they come up with something else that could down the line make it look less advantageous? Well, they could come up with, you know, let's say Steve Forbes, although he's aging now, but let's say that he won the presidency and he was able to control Congress and he eliminated the income tax and everything was a value added or a sales tax. And you paid all this money in taxes to do a Roth IRA conversion, then in hindsight, you would actually be worse off because you would have less total dollars. And in that scenario, total dollars is the key issue. Or maybe they could bring back one of the excise taxes. And I'm not going to say that that's not a possibility. This is what I would say. I think the odds of an income tax increase is far more likely and is likely far more dangerous than some of these, let's say, more obscure potential changes in the tax law. So I would probably say, if you're going to take into consideration future taxes, that probably that's even more reason to do some of these strategies like Roth IRA conversions and charitable remainder trusts, because the cost of not doing them will result in significantly higher taxes for you and your heirs.
So the next question is also from the live room. It's from Mohan, who asks, I am a retiree living in New Jersey. Do you have an attorney in our state that is affiliated with you? If not, how do I avail myself of your services?
Actually, we do have an attorney who's licensed in New York and New Jersey. His name is Bruce Steiner, and I highly recommend him. He understands IRAs about as well as any estate attorney that I know. He's always giving talks. He's been on my radio show multiple times. I've referred him a bunch of clients, and he would be a great choice. And he's, I'm sure, actually, I know he's spoken and written about the SECURE Act. So he would be a great choice. And I believe he's licensed in New York and New Jersey. So there you go. For, as a general rule, a lot of times people use us to run the numbers, and I'll explain that a little bit, or they have us manage a certain portion of their money, and they don't happen to be Pennsylvania residents. And what about their wills and trusts? Because we're not licensed in 50 states. In fact, we're only licensed in one. So we're not allowed to draft wills, trusts, charitable remainder trusts, etc. But we are allowed to look at your wills. We are allowed to make suggestions. And then we are allowed to help you find a local attorney who will do it. And we're allowed to review what the local attorney did to determine if we are happy and satisfied. So when we take a client, even if we're not legally allowed to draft their documents, we don't ignore that issue. And very frankly, there's a lot of attorneys who we don't have a lot of confidence in. Bruce Steiner, we have a lot of confidence in. So I hope that answers your question.
Great. And now we're going to go back to some of the questions that were submitted before the webinar today. This one comes from Donna in Dallas, Texas. She says, my husband is in skilled nursing, and I have more than enough to deduct medical expenses. I think it would be a good idea to pull money out of his IRA so that I can get it out and not have to pay tax on it. I have enough to pay without withdrawing, but I'm thinking this is an opportunity to pull money with no tax implications. I'm a tax professional, so I would be able to keep up with exactly how much to withdraw before the end of the year.
Well, first I'm going to talk generally, then I'm going to answer the question specifically. One of the greatest mistakes that I see in income tax preparation and planning is ignoring the potential for a huge medical expense related to either skilled care or a nursing home or some type of in-service provider. So let's say, so it's really important, find out how, and by the way, it also for a buy-in for one of these continuing care communities, usually with a little bit of digging, either you or the CPA can get a justifiable amount to deduct for medical expenses. In some cases, 100%, in other cases, not. But let's assume, Donna, that your husband's in skilled nursing, and just to make up a number, that $75,000 of the amount that you're paying for his care is deemed a medical expense. And your question is, can I take out that $75,000 from an IRA, either yours or your husband's? That's $75,000 of income, and let's forget about the limitations on the deductions, but you have to take those into account too. We have a $75,000 medical expense. The two of those offset each other, and there I just got $75,000 out of my IRA without having to pay tax. You're a tax professional, and presumably you can do the nuances, with exactly how much and tax brackets, blah, blah, blah. And the answer is you got it half right. All right. But for the same tax cost, which in effect is zero, instead of ending up with $75,000 of plain old after-tax dollars, why not make a $75,000 Roth IRA conversion? So your tax return is going to look the same. The difference is you're going to end up with $75,000 in a Roth IRA versus $75,000 of after-tax dollars. Now, if you need the money immediately for your expenses, then it's going to be a push. But let's say you don't need the money immediately for expenses. Let's assume that you have some other money. We'll do the Roth IRA conversion, spend the other money, and then have the Roth IRA grow either for the rest of your life or for as long as you can afford not to take it, and then maybe for an additional 10 years after you're gone. So you got it half right. But the big issue, and a lot of us have aging parents who have these kind of expenses, and they think, oh, well, my parents don't pay any taxes because they have such a big medical bill. No, don't think like that. Think how much money can we convert to a Roth? And by the way, there's in Medicare planning, we are looking at, which I don't really do, by the way, that's a whole elder law. There's a bunch of good estate attorneys that do that. Carol Sykoff Gross, Andy Sykes, these are Pittsburgh attorneys. There's some other people who do that. That's an area outside my expertise. So again, going back to Clint, a man's got to know his limitations. But I'll just say that Roth IRA and Medicare planning are not mutually exclusive. But I would look at Roth IRA conversions first before I would just take the money out and get a tax-free IRA distribution.
I wanted to jump back really quickly and take a question from the live room. Jane asks, Jim, you mentioned that you would explain more about what running the numbers is. Could you tell us exactly what that is, what that entails?
Okay, sure. So, Jane, for years, our basic model for assets under management is a very unique model. Our firm does what we call run the numbers, which involves me personally, and it takes roughly two full days of one of our highly trained CPAs. So we would get all your information. And by the way, with you there, it used to be physically, or if you lived far away virtually, now they're all virtual. We test different strategies. How much of a Roth IRA conversion should you make this year? How much next year? How much the year after? How much money can you afford to spend? Does it make sense to gift your child any money? If so, what form of gift? What about your grandkids' education? What about your will and trust? What's the ideal will and trust? And we review wills and trusts. The truth is, it is a much more manual process than you would guess. You would think these days with all this wonderful software, you just put in a bunch of numbers, hit maximize, and out comes a great strategy. This is much more like interpolation. Well, let's try this. Let's try no Roth. Let's try a big Roth. Let's do a series of small Roths. Let's do a series of small Roths and hold off on Social Security. Can you afford to buy a place? Well, I don't think anybody's going to buy a place in Florida these days, but maybe eventually. Can you afford to help your grandkids with their education? Should you get life insurance? All these questions. And what we do is we say, okay, here's scenario number one. Here's scenario number two. Here's scenario number three. So we do all these what ifs. Then the output of it, because it's a long process, and frankly, you're involved on every step of the way. The output is, it's like maybe a three or four page letter. Hey, we looked at all these different scenarios. We eliminated all but two or three. Here's the spreadsheets for the two or three that we like the best. here is the reason why both you and I, that is you, the client, and us, the advisor, liked scenario number three, because it was the best for your family down the road, blah, blah, blah. It's not 70 pages of boilerplate that a computer spits out based on some of the numbers that you have done. It's very individualized. It takes us a lot of time. And originally, we only did that for asset under management clients. So we did that. Then we updated it every year. And then we had a money manager actually manage the money. And how did we get paid? Well, we split the fee with the money manager. So we have a minimum of $1 million. Of course, the fee's a lot lower if it's more than $1 million, but let's keep it simple. Let's assume that the fee is 1% and it's a $10,000 fee. So we would get $5,000. The money manager would get $5,000. And it was a win-win, still is. It's a win-win-win, meaning it's great for the money manager because he gets a client he would not have otherwise. It's great for us because we get to run the numbers and do all the strategies that we love. And it's great for the client because normally you pay 1% just to have somebody manage the money, and you typically don't get the strategies, or you get the wrong strategies, like the 70-year-old woman whose advisor said, don't do a Roth. So that is our basic model. And by the way, if you are interested in that model, the asset under management model, you start with filling out a questionnaire that goes to me. I determine if I think we can help you, that I like to give the client at least 10 times the value that we're charging in terms of fees, but I'll see, well, yes, I think that they are a good fit. We're only looking for good fits. We're a service firm. We want to provide great service. We want to provide great value. And then we will say, okay, then I talk with the person. If it looks like a good fit, then I have the client talk with the money manager, because you have to be happy with both us and the money manager. The money manager, by the way, uses what we think is the best low-cost enhanced index funds on the planet called Dimensional Fund Advisors. We think they're a wonderful set of funds. He's a great CPA, CFP. He has a 40-step process. He runs the numbers in his, differently than us. His is more investment-oriented. He works for a great firm called Buckingham. The underlying fund, the closest thing to it is probably Vanguard, but it's a $500 billion company. You know, it's not Jim's mutual funds. Anyway, that is our primary model, but we have run into, and it's been relatively frequent, a whole bunch of people who say, hey, Jim, I'm happy with my money manager. Hey, Jim, I'm a do-it-yourself Vanguard guy, but I do see the value in coming up with a master plan, and I love the idea of having people that really know what they're doing go through my numbers with me being part of the process, coming up with a master plan, and just charging a flat fee for it. So we are doing that. That's available for $7,500 now. Eventually, we will be so busy with the assets under management that we will probably not continue doing the run the numbers for a flat fee service. But as of at least right now, that service is available. We prefer having continuity. So just as an example, I'm a big believer in masks. I don't mean to get political, but I believe in masks. And my wife found a great source of masks from China. And they were the KN95. They weren't medical quality, but they were, you know, much better than the cloth mask or most masks that you could get. And I was able to procure, I think, about 10,500 masks. And we gave probably more than half to different charities and healthcare organizations, but we also sent out a lot to our clients. In fact, every single client got at least two. And now I'm getting all these notes from people who I've been doing business with for 10, 20, 30, and I hate to admit it, but some even more years than that. And it's very gratifying to me having that long-term relationship where I remember people's names, I remember their situation, and that's still our primary business for assets under management. Then we have this running the numbers. And by the way, we're also a law firm, but we limit it just to estate planning, and that's just for Pennsylvania residents. And we're not really looking for business because we have more than we can handle anyway, but we're also a traditional CPA firm. And the reason that's probably important for some of you is sometimes people like what I'll call a one-stop shop, where you could have the same firm do the estate plan, do the tax return, and do the planning. So it's very valuable for that. We're not looking for an income tax only client. So if you said, hey, Jim, I have a great financial advisor, I don't want to run the numbers, I live outside Pennsylvania, or I'm happy with my will, can you just do a tax return for us? I'd likely say no. But for some of the other services, yes. And for that, running the numbers, at least for now, it is available. Very honestly, I think that that's a fabulous strategy for you to hire us to run the numbers for the do-it-yourself investors, or if you have an advisor that you're happy with. And this is the other thing that I'm getting, is sometimes people know that we would be a better choice, but out of personal loyalty, they stick with their existing advisor. Personally, I think that you owe your loyalty to your family, not to your advisor. And I wouldn't want anybody to stay with me if they could find somebody better or more appropriate because of personal loyalty to me. But anyway, for those people, the $7,500, I think we call it a financial game plan, is a great value.
We hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. If you've discovered the answers to your questions and would like to schedule an appointment with Jim, please call Alice at our offices at 1-800-387-1129. That number again is 1-800-387-1129. Or if you would like to attend one of Jim's upcoming webinars, go to paytaxeslater.com/2020webinars. That address again is paytaxeslater.com/2020webinars. That's 2020 webinars.